Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week, we present Gabor Rona, International Legal Director with Human Rights First, who explains why he rejects claims by former Bush administration officials who argue that U.S. torture was instrumental in locating Osama bin Laden. Chris Tenzing, editor of Middle East Report, who assesses how the U.S. and Israel are likely to respond to a new accord signed by rival Palestinian parties, Fatah and Hamas. And Ben Mansky, coordinator of Wisconsin Wave, who discusses the current status of the progressive grassroots mobilization resisting Wisconsin GOP Governor Scott Walker's conservative anti-union agenda. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Syrian army has laid siege to several cities in an attempt to crush the nonviolent citizen uprising seeking to oust President Bashar Assad. The latest target of Syria's repression is the city of Banias, a key oil exporting center and hub of protest over the last 2 months. Troops have cut off services like electricity, telephone, and the internet while rounding up opposition activists. Human rights groups say over 750 civilians have been killed since the uprising started in March. The city of Homs, another hotspot of protest, saw over 20,000 people recently march in a funeral for 7 activists killed by security forces. Brutal security operations are also taking place in the Damascus suburb of Manamia, which has been sealed off. In recent days, the National Organization for Human Rights in Syria reports that more than 1,000 people were detained by Syrian police after a wave of mass arrests. Amar Karabi, head of the Syrian Human Rights Network, stated, "These arrests have transformed Syria into a large prison." President Assad has been warned by Turkish officials not to commit a massacre of the opposition, similar to what his father, President Hafez al-Assad, perpetrated in 1982, when government forces were charged with killing an estimated 30,000 people. Months before an elite U.S. military team killed Osama bin Laden in his hideout in Pakistan, there was a strong movement toward crafting a new peace formula in Afghanistan, including the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the United States. In the short run, the Taliban may have launched a new offensive against NATO forces, but sources say pressure will mount for a political settlement through a unity government as the U.S. war in Afghanistan approaches its 10th anniversary. The raid against bin Laden has placed added pressure on the Taliban to cut all ties with al-Qaeda, whose forces have little military presence inside Afghanistan. According to the Christian Science Monitor, movement toward a peace agreement includes Turkey, which is now allowing the Taliban to open an office in the pro-Western Muslim country, while Afghanistan and Pakistan initiated a joint peace commission. The covert American raid that killed bin Laden inside Pakistan has also put hardliners that block past peace efforts within the Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI, on the defensive. Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, a possible Republican presidential candidate, has pledged to cut off all funding for Planned Parenthood in the Midwestern state. Conservatives claim any funding for Planned Parenthood's health clinics is an indirect subsidy for abortion. By pushing ahead on defunding Planned Parenthood, Daniels, the former budget chief for George W. Bush, is on shaky constitutional grounds. Medicaid, the federal program which pays for health care for the poor, provides patients a choice on selecting any health provider who is qualified to offer medical services. The Los Angeles Times reports Indiana is the first state to bar health care funding for any entity that performs abortions or maintains or operates a facility where abortions are performed. In Indiana, only 4 of Planned Parenthood's 28 health clinics perform abortions. Mary Cohn, a spokeswoman for the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, says Indiana's funding ban is illegal. But the Obama administration has few options to sanction Indiana other than to simply shut down the program, notes George Washington University law professor Sarah Rosenbaum, who added she expects more states with conservative anti-abortion governors and legislatures to also try to defund Planned Parenthood. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
It wasn't long after President Obama's May 1st announcement that a U.S. Navy SEAL commando team had killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan that former members of the Bush administration and their allies celebrated the role they claimed U.S. torture of terrorist suspects had played in locating the al-Qaeda leader. Former Vice President Dick Cheney said that waterboarding, which was banned by President Obama in January 2009, was, quote, a good program. It was a legal program. It was not torture. I would strongly recommend we continue it. While the former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld stated, quote, it was a mistake to rule out waterboarding. It's clear that those techniques that the CIA used worked. The motivation of former members of the Bush administration for defending torture is transparent, as their actions are considered war crimes under international law, and as individuals could be subject to prosecution when they travel abroad. But apart from the legal issues, most interrogation experts agree that the only effective method of extracting reliable information from detainees is to use non-coercive methods and to build trust with suspects. General David Petraeus, who commands U.S. forces in Afghanistan and has been selected by President Obama to head the CIA, has asserted many times that U.S. torture serves as a major terrorist recruiting tool. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gabor Rona, International Legal Director with Human Rights First, who explains why he rejects claims that torture is an effective interrogation method and believes that the abuse of terrorist suspects hindered efforts in locating Osama bin Laden.
The moment that the news, you know, flashed about the bin Laden operation, people from within the former Bush administration got to work to try to credit this to the policies of George Bush, and particularly the detention and interrogation policies of Bush. And there were a good number of reasons why they would want to do that. Of course, everybody wants their work to be shown in the best light. But when their work amounts to war crimes, and when they have to be concerned about the possibility of being prosecuted for war crimes, then they have an extra incentive to put a different face on their policies. And I think it's quite knee-jerk, and obviously knee-jerk, that the purveyors of torture policy in the Bush administration are the same people who came out and said that Osama bin Laden's death is attributable to these so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, torture. And the reason I think it's way too generous to call this thing even a debate is that what they're doing is simply making the allegation. And unfortunately, in today's kind of media slugfest, making an allegation seems to be the equivalent of making it stick. But if you listen to the details, and the details are already known, then you would come up with a very different conclusion than torture works. What we hear from Cheney and John Yoo and others in the Bush administration who were big fans of these policies is that Guantanamo detainees were subjected to waterboarding, which is also somewhat of a euphemism for suffocation. And when they were subjected to waterboarding, they later gave information leading to a courier that led the United States to Osama bin Laden. And if that's all you know, you would conclude that there was a cause and effect relationship between torture and getting this information. The reality is that people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the Guantanamo detainees, and another Guantanamo detainee were waterboarded many, many, many times over. In the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, 183 instances in the course of 1 month, and he divulged nothing about couriers leading to Osama bin Laden. Then, many months, something like a year after the brutal interrogations stopped and lawful interrogations took their place, that's when KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, gave the information that led to the courier. So rather than saying that torture leads to information that leads to Osama bin Laden, which is how some would have it, it seems to me much more logical to conclude that torture actually impeded the ability of the United States to gain intelligence that would have led much, much earlier to bin Laden. And You know, how many instances of terrorism could have been prevented if the United States had started and ended with lawful interrogation techniques instead of torture is the real speculation here.
Gabor Rona, maybe you could tell us a bit about the motivation of some of these former Bush administration officials who were involved in administering or ordering these torture techniques and what they've got at stake in terms of possible future prosecution here in the United States or internationally, so that they certainly have a stake in defending their policies that they were involved in vis-a-vis torture.
It does look like, at the very least, many of these Bush officials that were responsible for promulgating and implementing torture policies are not going to be traveling to Western European countries anytime soon for fear of being indicted and arrested there. However, the best information we get is that the U.S. government has made efforts to try to get some of those countries like Germany and Spain to back off these former Bush officials because it would be embarrassing for the United States, bad for Obama, for whatever reason. In the United States, any time the Obama administration does something in connection with torture policy, some of these folks, like Cheney, like you, like Addington, Bybee, are not only ready and willing, but available and are called upon by the media in the U.S. to give their points and counterpoints, when instead they should actually be being prosecuted in federal courts for what they've done. And what they've done is nothing more or less than order and implement policies of torture, and in situations of armed conflict, that's a war crime, plain and simple, under international law and under U.S. law.
That was Gabor Rona, International Legal Director with Human Rights First. Find more information on human rights groups' views on torture on our website at btlonline.org. On May 4th, Fatah, the Palestinian faction that rules the West Bank, and Hamas, the Islamist faction that controls Gaza, signed a pact in Cairo that would unite the two rival parties to form a transitional government and hold long-delayed elections in both territories within a year. Because Hamas has refused to renounce violence or recognize Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, Israel condemned the move, while the Obama administration is taking a wait-and-see approach. The Palestinian Accord puts at risk hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. aid for Fatah's Washington-supported Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, since the U.S. considers Hamas a terrorist organization and could refuse to fund any government that they're a part of. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Chris Tenzing, longtime editor of Middle East Report, about the Palestinian Accord. He says the reconciliation was a response to the grassroots Palestinian demand to end the debilitating division that presented a major obstacle for the resumption of meaningful negotiations with Israel. The pact also sets the stage for an effort to pursue international recognition of a Palestinian state at the United Nations this September. Tenzing addresses how the U.S. and Israel are likely to respond to Hamas and what Hamas and Fatah both hope to gain from this new arrangement.
I would say Israel and the U.S. are setting up hurdles for Hamas that Hamas cannot jump over, and I think Israel and the U.S. know that. Specifically, the hurdles are the so-called quartet conditions that were put in place, I believe, in 2006 as conditions for Hamas to join the U.S.-sponsored peace process alongside other Palestinian parties. And those conditions would be acceptance of previous agreements that Palestinians have made with Israel, the Oslo Accords, and so on, renouncing all forms of violence, and accepting Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. And Hamas is not going to give a firm answer one way or another to either of those conditions. On the question of violence, Hamas will say that they offer a long-term ceasefire, which, of course, they have done in the past and have observed in the past, largely without incident, not completely, but largely. And that's for the reason that Hamas does not want to appear to Palestinians as being sort of unilaterally disarming in the conflict. And since Hamas has won a large part of its current political support from Palestinians, even those who are not Islamist, on the strength of resisting what Palestinians see as Israeli aggression against them, then Hamas could not sort of appear to be laying down its arms without some kind of promise of the same from Israel. And then with regard to the second question of accepting Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state, that relates to the right of return for Palestinian refugees, also the future status of Palestinian citizens of Israel, who Hamas or Fatah, for that matter, as leaders of the Palestinian people as a whole, consider themselves in some representative relationship to. So the idea there is that they don't want to appear to be sort of saying that any agreement with Israel is now and forever to forestall any unification of the Palestinian people and the diaspora in the lands from which those people were expelled in 1948. It's very unlikely that Hamas will, you know, agree to those things. And so since they're not going to agree to those things, that largely drowns out the news, which is that, you know, Khaled Mashal, the spokesman of Hamas based in Damascus, has stated very clearly this time, with no sort of ambiguity whatsoever, that Hamas will recognize the pre-1967 borders as the provisional borders of an Israel and a Palestine, with Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, and with settlements in the West Bank removed and no land swaps. I mean, it was a very clear statement that Mashal made. So basically, Hamas is going a considerable distance, further, in fact, than they have gone to date. And the response so far of Israel has been to reject the agreement, and the response of the United States has been wait and see, but keep the existing blockades and so on in place.
It's a pretty big financial gamble for Abbas to risk millions in U.S. support. Even if the Obama administration is taking a wait-and-see attitude, I can imagine members of Congress moving to cut funding, you know, pretty much immediately. Do you agree?
I'm sure that that they do regard it as something of a gamble, but I think they probably think that it's a gamble they had no choice but to make. The alternative to make no attempt on the Palestinian side to set the agenda or seize the initiative would be to leave the status quo to fester. And the status quo is untenable for the Palestinians. The best that the Palestinians could hope for under Netanyahu or under a successor government led by the Kadima Party, the, you know, what is now called the centrist party in Israel, which is leading in most of the polls that are taken, the best that the Palestinians could hope for would be a unilateral Israeli declaration of a Palestinian state based on provisional borders, which would have no guarantees about any of these so-called final status issues, in which Israel would retain all sorts of rights and all sorts of impingements upon Palestinian sovereignty. And that just would essentially be basically a legalization of the status quo. So if the Palestinians are going to have any measure of real sovereignty, they have a considerable obligation here to try to set the agenda on something closer to their own terms. And that's what I think they have done. And we can't leave out the popular pressure either, which is a very important factor. And in the broader environment of the Arab world, in the wake of the Tunisian Revolution and the Egyptian Revolution and the outbreak of popular uprisings across the Arab world, including Syria and other countries, and mass protests in Jordan, and countries very close to Palestine with large Palestinian refugee populations, there was a great deal of pressure on the Palestinian leadership to put aside their own differences, which were considerable, and try to work together toward a common national goal.
That was Chris Tenzing of Middle East Report. Find a link to the latest reports on the Israel-Palestine conflict at our website at btlonline.org. Enormous protests in Wisconsin during February and March, organized to oppose Republican Governor Scott Walker's legislation that would have all but eliminated public employee unions' collective bargaining rights, have tapered off in recent weeks. But although the national media spotlight has dimmed on the spirited movement that saw over 100,000 demonstrators descend on and occupy the Capitol in Madison, The progressive campaign to derail Scott Walker's hard-right conservative agenda goes on. Union activists and their supporters throughout the state gathered enough petition signatures to secure recall elections against six Republican state senators who supported Walker's anti-union bill, a measure now being challenged in the courts. Republicans have mounted their own recall petitions, targeting three Democratic state senators, with the first recall elections scheduled to be held this July. If Republicans should lose three seats in the state Senate, control will shift to the Democrats and could obstruct Walker's agenda. The prospect of losing control of the Wisconsin Senate has moved Governor Walker to accelerate efforts to win passage of other elements of his legislative agenda, including requiring voters to show photo identification at the polls, expansion of Wisconsin's school voucher program, legalizing the carrying of concealed weapons, deregulating the telephone industry, and repealing early release for prisoners. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ben Mansky, executive director of the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution and coordinator of Wisconsin Wave, groups that are organizing resistance to Walker's legislation. Here, Mansky discusses the current status of the progressive grassroots mobilization in Wisconsin.
Well, I mean, the governor came out of the starting gate at top speed, and so they already have done a lot of damage. They did a lot of damage ahead of February 11th with so-called tort reform, protecting major corporations from people they've harmed. They've got that through. They've been rushing through voter ID legislation. Wisconsin has had some of the most progressive voting rights law in the country for generations. They're trying to undo that by making it much harder for people to vote in this state. But I will say that despite the fact that the governor is pushing as hard as he can because he sees that there is not a light at the end of the tunnel for him, but maybe a wall at the end of the tunnel, he is getting slowed down a bit. I mean, the voter ID bill, which is going to a vote in the state assembly, is very different from what they originally introduced. And I think that what you're seeing is that there are Republican members of the legislature who are looking at those recalls and also looking at, for example, a special election that happened in a historically Republican district outside of La Crosse in the far west part of the state, in which a fairly progressive Democrat was elected in this special election. So they're looking at that. They have their own agendas. Not all of them are crazy. Some of them have roots in the old Republican Party in Wisconsin, and we only need a couple of them to come to their senses. So I think that, you know, certainly they're pushing very hard right now. We're pushing back, and I'm very optimistic.
Ben, what are the chances are that the Republicans, the party of Scott Walker, will lose control of the state Senate when these recall elections go forward this summer?
Well, I think the chances are good. The momentum is still entirely on our side. You know, the governor can't go anywhere without getting protested. He tried to do a fishing photo op in northwest Wisconsin the other day, and people went out there in boats and surrounded him with signs. You know, the momentum is very strong right now, I think, for the broader progressive movement. And one thing that's kind of unique about where things are in Wisconsin right now is that you see this real sense of a broader movement that's it's beyond elections, beyond partisan politics. You know, the question will be what happens if and when the Democrats take back the Senate. Will the progressive wing of the Democratic Party still find itself in the driver's seat? Will the broader progressive movement, unions, environmental movement, the student movement, farm movement, community organizers be in a position to continue to push forward? Or will the one or two Democrats in the state Senate, who we know to be problems, will they find that they want to work with the other side of the aisle? And it's going to be our job to make that impossible for them.
Ben, I've been reading about the election for state Supreme Court judge that has gone into a recount, pitting conservative David Prosser, who's the sitting judge in the Supreme Court, against his challenger, Joanne Kloppenburg. Just a couple of hundred votes separated these two when the polls were counted up initially, with Kloppenburg, the challenger, more identified with progressive politics, winning. But then all of a sudden, in Waukesha County, thousands of votes were discovered, uncounted, and giving Prosser a 7,000 vote advantage, something like that. This vote count has been challenged, and there's a recount going on, as I understand it. But fill our listeners in on what's at stake and how this process is moving forward.
Well, what's at stake is that you have a Supreme Court that is nominally nonpartisan and but which definitely has various justices who represent different interests. And in terms of that balance, you have four justices who generally favor corporate interests, and you have three who generally stand on the side of the people. David Prosser is one of those incumbent conservative pro-corporate justices. Joanne Kloppenburg is somebody who definitely comes out of the progressive movement. I mean, she was attacked for that in the campaign, was actually attacked for donating money to my campaign. In the course of the campaign by her opponent. And so this would be a major shift in terms of the balance on the court. And that, of course, is important because everything Scott Walker is doing, from our point of view, runs afoul of numerous elements of the state constitution, also equal protection, due process guarantees at the federal level. So the Supreme Court in Wisconsin is pivotal. What has happened with the recount is that despite pressure from some, frankly, within the Democratic Party, the Kloppenburg campaign went ahead and filed the recount, is moving ahead, and we have found this past Friday, due to volunteers who have been following the recounts in various counties, that there have been numerous problems around the state, as we expected, and in Waukesha County, lo and behold, we had literally thousands of votes in ballot bags that were unsealed, that, in other words, that the chain of custody had been broken in the cases of these votes. And so the recount continues. There are observers who are following it day in, day out. And it's really essential that we continue to receive support for our efforts to turn out volunteers. There's a recount watch button on the Wisconsin Wave website that listeners can check out.
That was Ben Mansky, coordinator of Wisconsin Wave and executive director of the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution. Learn more about progressive organizing in Wisconsin by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.